stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. As many as 700 migrants trying to reach a better life in Europe are feared dead as their boat capsized overnight off the Libyan coast. Authorities said today at least 28 people have been rescued and 24 bodies recovered, but hundreds are missing in what could become the worst known Mediterranean migrant sea disaster. The boat capsized 193 kilometers south of the southern Italian island of Lampedusa when it is believed migrants moved to one side of the vessel as a merchant ship approached. Hours after a suicide bomber in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, killed at least 35 people and wounded scores of others, Kabul's military chief, General Sher Mohammad Karimi, in an unprecedented speech in neighboring Pakistan, called for both nations to step up counterterrorism efforts.
The ongoing strategic dialogue between our two countries gives me great hope, and we all need to redouble our earnest, sincere efforts so that we help realize the noble and rightful aspiration of millions of our citizens for a life of peace, security, dignity, and prosperity.
Afghanistan and Pakistan have for years accused each other of harboring militants responsible for attacks in the other country. Islamic State claims to have massacred 30 Ethiopian Christians in Libya in a video similar to previous publicized killings by the extremist militants. The graphic footage posted online today and viewed by VOA shows one group of men beheaded on a beach as they knelt in front of their executioners, and another shot in the back of the head at a different location. We invite you to stop on by our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Iran's supreme leader lashed out at the United States today, accusing Washington of inventing the myth of Tehran's nuclear weapons threat. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also urged defensive preparedness for Iranian armed forces after a top U.S. general warned last week about military action against Tehran's nuclear sites. Diplomats from both countries are building on a framework nuclear deal that paves the way to ease economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for limitations on Tehran's nuclear development. A leading contender for president of the African Development Bank wants to see a strong, regionally integrated Africa with increasing growth that is globally competitive. In an interview with VOA, Nigeria's agricultural minister, Akinwumi Adesina, said there are worrying trends that he will address if elected.
First is to focus on smart infrastructure to allow increased productivity and efficiency of growth. Secondly is to work on private sector. Private sector for wealth creation, creating SMEs and financing and stuff like that for them. The third one is to jobs for Africa's youth and jobs for Africa's women. The fourth area I'm going to put a lot of emphasis on is reviving rural economies.
Adesina says his many years of work in Francophone and Anglophone countries, coupled with his passion to help eradicate poverty in Africa, qualifies him to become the next president of the African Development Bank. A leading U.S. newspaper says the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Justice Department have formally acknowledged that almost all of the examiners in an elite FBI forensic unit gave flawed testimony against criminal defendants for more than a two-decade period before the year 2000. The Washington Post reported Saturday that according to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the Innocence Project, that 26 of the 28 examiners with the FBI's laboratory's microscopic hair comparison unit overstated forensic matches to favor prosecutors in more than 95% of the 268 trials reviewed so far. The reviewed cases included 32 defendants who were sentenced to death. 14 of them have either been executed or died in prison, the two groups said. About 1,000 people gathered at the former site of the Oklahoma City Federal Building to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the terrorist bombing there that killed 168 people and injured many others. Former President Bill Clinton and Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon were among those who spoke at today's service at the Oklahoma City National Memorial, where the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building once stood. Service started with a 168-second moment of silence and concluded with survivors and tearful relatives of the dead reading the names of those killed in the April 19, 1995 attack. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The needs are quite vast, and the programs that are expected to be undertaken is so large that a country like Indonesia would not be sufficient, or any developing country would not be sufficient enough to not also cooperate with other colleagues from the developed countries.
First Asia-Africa Summit opens in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, today.
As president of the Africa Development Bank, I have laid out a vision, you know, as a president of the bank, that will address this particular trend as well. You know, first is to focus on smart infrastructure.
A Nigerian cabinet minister seeks to become the next president of the African Development Bank. We'll have details.
Mr. Fabre says if elected, he will put proposed constitutional reforms to a referendum. He says those reforms include limiting the president to 2 5-year terms, effective immediately.
And political parties in Togo intensify their campaigns ahead of the April 25th general election. We'll have a report. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The week-long Asia-Africa Conference 60th anniversary commemoration opened Sunday in Jakarta with representatives from 77 countries in attendance and over 30 heads of state expected to participate. The Indonesian organizers see this conference as means to increase development and cooperation programs between developing countries. Reporter Pardon has more.
The first Asia-Africa conference was held in Bandung, Indonesia in 1955 to advocate for liberation from colonial rule and resist undue influence from the two major superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. At the 60th anniversary commemoration in Jakarta and Bandung, Indonesian Foreign Ministry spokesman Armanata Nasir says the focus this time is different.
I think the major theme is development. It's ensuring that the people of Asia and Africa grows away from poverty, reducing the development gaps between Asia and Africa.
The original Asia-Africa conference led to the founding of the Non-Aligned Movement. With the end of the Cold War, some analysts questioned the multinational organization's relevance. Its meetings often produced anti-Western rhetoric but no cooperative programs. This year, Indonesian President Joko Widodo wants to give developing nations a new framework based on cooperation and development. During the conference, the Indonesian organizers will promote increasing South-South cooperation, a term that means direct cooperation among developing countries, and triangular cooperation that involves developing countries working alongside advanced Western countries to provide assistance. Dian Triansyah Yani, a high-ranking official in Indonesia's foreign ministry, highlighted how his country, with funding and support from Norway, is providing 45 assistance programs to Afghanistan in the fields of health, education, and agriculture, among others. He says no one country can do it alone.
The needs are quite vast, and the programs that are expected to be undertaken is so large that a country like Indonesia would not be sufficient, or any developing country would not be sufficient enough to not also cooperate with other colleagues from the developed countries.
Norway's ambassador to Jakarta, Stig Travik, says countries in the Islamic world can more easily relate to Indonesia's experience in development and democracy as the world's largest Muslim-majority country.
Indonesia is a superpower in one area, and that is in pragmatism, tolerance, and moderation.
Organizers say also they want to increase the power and influence of developing countries in the United Nations, although China, France, Russia, Britain, and the United States hold veto power as permanent members of the Security Council. Later in the week, the heads of state from China, Japan, South Africa, Ethiopia, and Pakistan are scheduled to address the conference. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
A leading contender for the president of the African Development Bank wants to see a strong, regionally integrated Africa with increasing growth and a continent globally competitive. Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, who is also Nigeria's agricultural minister, was in our studios here in Washington, D.C. He told me earlier that his many years of work in both Francophone and Anglophone countries, coupled with his passion to help eradicate poverty in Africa, uniquely qualifies him to become the next president of the African Development Bank.
As president of the Africa Development Bank, I have laid out a vision, you know, as a president of the bank that will address this particular trend well. You know, first is to focus on smart infrastructure to allow increased productivity and efficiency of growth, you know, and competitiveness for Africa. Secondly is to work on private sector. Private sector for wealth creation, creating SMEs and financing and stuff like that for them. The third one is to jobs for Africa's youth and jobs for Africa's women. The fourth area I'm going to put a lot of emphasis on is reviving rural economies to create shared prosperity and inclusive growth on the continent. And finally, the raison d'etre of the bank is regional integration. So it's going to be regional integration with shared prosperity. So I bring to this particular issue a tremendous amount of experience. Having lived and worked in more than 15 African countries, I know Africa well. I consider myself a pan-African candidate. I grew up in a rural area. You know, I came out of poverty, and I bring a passion, a pulse, to make sure that the Africa Development Bank can deploy resources to unlock hope and opportunity for many. So my focus is going to be a lot more on people-level impact.
Talking about integration of Africa, sometimes people express concern about the lack of political will in the integration of Africa. How do you think this impact on the activities of the bank?
Well,
and what would you change about that?
Africa has no choice but to integrate. Because, you know, if you look at the size of our market, every single country is a very small market, except for maybe South Africa or Nigeria. These are big, big markets. But, you know, we can trade a lot more within our, you know, among ourselves. The amount of trade going on between African countries is very, very low. It's only 12% compared to over 48%, you know, in Asia, and compared to about almost 47% in the North Africa, you know, North America free trade area, and almost 70% in Europe. So Africa has no option but to grow the size of its regional market. Now there is a lot of political commitment actually to that, but a lot of this has to also move faster beyond just the rhetorics and the political commitment to it, which is all great, but what needs to be done is the issue. I think a number of critical issues the bank can support. First is have a lot more greater harmonizations of customs and regulations across country. You know, having one border post that makes it easier for people just to pass goods and services can move in quickly would reduce the cost of doing business and therefore facilitate a lot more intra-regional trade. Investing in infrastructure, I mean, ports, the port of Abidjan or the port in Senegal can are the ports critical to and so on. So making strategic investment in those kind of ports will make it easier for landlocked countries to actually get in there. Or if you are looking at corridors, just like the Inkala corridor, you know, out of Obiera corridor in Mozambique, are very critical for Malawi and Zambia and so on. So these kind of transnational ports and also transnational highways are very important for the bank to continue to invest in. But I also think that when you look at waterways and go to the Manu River area where you have transboundary water resources that are very important for integration. The bank needs to support the development of those facilities. And I also think that regional infrastructure, I mean, take ICT, for example, regional ICT infrastructure that allows the continent to reduce the cost of bandwidth so that you can actually have easier connectivity, you know, between countries. We speed up the speed of business, you know, and allow Africa to, let me say, become a center for business process outsourcing, just like India, just like Philippines, and just like other countries in Asia. So this regional infrastructure, it's very, very important. And I think these are areas, as president of the bank, that I will continue to deepen investment in. And I must say that at the end of the day, though, movement of people. People have to be able to move freely, you know. I'm from Nigeria, and you're from Ghana, and somebody's from Malawi, or somebody from Zambia. You've got to be able to move around. And my perspective always is, even when we talk about, you know, being African, why don't we have you know, easier movement. It's easier for me to go to Europe and America than it is to travel to another African country. So I think free mobility is very important. Let's break down all these barriers. We don't need those barriers in Africa. We need a united, prosperous Africa where we are all very proud to be Africans. So where I live is just where I live. Mm-hmm. Where I'm born is where I'm born. Mm-hmm. But I'm an African.
Right.
And I'm at home in every part of Africa. Mm.
Let's talk about the fragility of Africa and the impact it has on the bank. Recently, elections were held in Nigeria. The president, incumbent president, lost. You were there. What trend do you think Nigeria is... the pace that Nigeria is setting at this moment, that Africa could copy or emulate, that will help the work of the bank?
Well, first and foremost, I think there is nothing better than democracy.
Right.
Democracy gives an expansion of the public sphere for people to express themselves. And I think I'm so proud to be a Nigerian, because of the way that our leaders have actually shown great African and global example. You know, first and foremost, the outgoing president, set up a very independent system, never, tinkered with it. He lost the election, but he considered the election even before it was announced. The incoming president showed resilience, and constantly continued to pursue the democratic space, and that shows great leadership, and the transition going on in Nigeria is totally, it's very smooth, And that tells you that Nigeria's democracy is matured, deepened, and we need that all across Africa's countries.
Dr. Akinwumi Adesina is Nigeria's agricultural minister and contesting to become the next president of the African Development Bank. He spoke with me from here in the nation's capital. Togo enters its last week of campaigning before the April 25th presidential poll. Viewers and Luke has this look at the candidates and the top issues of the campaign with reporting from Lomé by Modeste Masavusu.
Candidates are crisscrossing Togo in search of votes. President Fourie Gnassingbé is running for a controversial third term, while his four opponents call for change. The opposition tried and failed to get Parliament to put a two-term limit in the Constitution last year. The Gnassingbé family has ruled Togo since Gnassingbé Eyadema took power in a military coup in 1967. His son stepped into the office in 2005 when his father died. On the campaign trail, Mr. Gnassingbé says continuity offers the best hope for development. He told voters in the town of Noche that there is, quote, no time to waste.
La santé. Dans mes déplacements, beaucoup me disent, nous voulons l'extension de INAM.
He says people want universal health care and safe drinking water. He says it's time to transform agriculture. Should we be growing more than just corn? And what we grow, he says, should we be exporting it or processing it locally? Agriculture employs most of the population, and he says these are top questions for the next 5 years. Mr. Gnassingbé's top challenger in this election is longtime opposition figure Jean-Pierre Fabre. Mr. Fabre told VOA his, quote, core commitment is the rule of law and institutional reform.
Notre engagement primordial est en faveur de l'état de droit et des réformes institutionnelles. Dès mon élection,
Mr. Fabre says if elected, he will put proposed constitutional reforms to a referendum. He says those reforms include limiting the president to 2 5-year terms, effective immediately, strengthening the powers of the prime minister, and ensuring equitable distribution of resources. Disputes over 2010 election results led to violent street protests. Both Mr. Gnassingbé and Mr. Fabre claimed victory. Official results showed Mr. Gnassingbé with 60% of votes and Mr. Fabre with 33%. But Mr. Fabre's camp alleged fraud and voter intimidation. Six parties are boycotting this election. Three other parties told their supporters to vote for Mr. Gnassingbé. The poll had to be delayed 10 days when the opposition refused to approve the voter register, which it said contained tens of thousands of double registrations. The vote only went ahead after the International Organization of the Francophonie sent mediators and experts who removed 4,000 duplicate registrations. Voters say they want a peaceful election. The other candidates are lawyer Chisona Traore ex-military officer turned businessman Jerry Tama and university professor M.H. Aborigoge. Among the pledges being made are three meals a day for all Togolese and sweeping reforms to state administration and regional districting to, among other things, allow for local elections later this year. Decentralization has been a hot-button issue for decades. Togo has never held local elections. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
And several South African cities are grappling with violent attacks against foreigners. These are the worst xenophobic attacks in a decade in South Africa, with five people killed and thousands displaced in the last few weeks. What are the reasons behind this violence? For the UAE, Emily Eub has this report.
In the usually quiet coastal city of Durban in KwaZulu-Natal province, South Africa, the latest wave of xenophobic attacks started a couple of weeks ago in townships. Shops owned by foreigners were looted. Tension kept on scaling up and soon reached the city center as foreigners continued to flock to refugee camps. But how did it all start? For KwaZulu-Natal violence monitor Mary De Haas, all it needed was a spark. In this case, it came from King Goodwill Zwelithini of the Zulu tribe, which is in the majority in the province, when he said that all foreigners should go home. Attacks started soon after.
I think it's been brewing for quite a while. I'm told that even before the king made this famous speech of his about foreigners must go, that there was a lot of lobbying to get rid of foreign business people because they were competing with the locals. People use what the king said as a pretext to, the king's given us the go-ahead, so let's do it.
It is not the first xenophobic attack that South Africa has faced. In 2008, 62 people died in similar anti-immigrant attacks. The main grievance is that foreigners are taking South African jobs. Last year, the national unemployment rate reached 25%, its highest level since 2008. More than half the South African population lives under the poverty line. Locals claim foreign shop owners slash the prices because they dodge taxes. They say foreign workers work for low wages and break the market for the locals. De Haas says all the assertions, even if not all true, lay bare the dysfunction of the state institutions.
There's all sorts of resentments, ranging from fairly unsophisticated local people who are cross because the local business seems to be doing well, to the more sophisticated people who talk about the failure of the immigration authorities to stem the influx of residents. Also allegations that some of these people are voting here illegally because Home Affairs has provided them with documentation, which again gets back to resentment over resources, economic, political resources, which of course lies at the heart of this, no doubt.
De Haas says these attacks did not happen out of the blue.
I don't think it's spontaneous. I think it's pretty well planned. This should have been picked up and detected if people have been talking about this. I mean, one man said to me, nope, the feeling is foreigners must go. If they don't go by December, there'll be a bloodbath. Now, people have been talking about this for months. Why have the police not been proactive?
As Durban still experiences violence, similar xenophobic attacks have spread to other cities in the last few weeks, including Pietermaritzburg and Johannesburg. Emily Yab for VOA News in Durban.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's government has signed up for a new plan to stabilize North Kivu, the DRC province with the worst levels of violence and insecurity. The plan's authors say it involves more local consultation than previous plans. For VOA, Nick Long has more from the North Kivu capital, Goma.
The plan is really a continuation of a stabilization and reconstruction program known as STAREC that was launched in 2009 and ran out of funding 3 years later. By then, donors had lost confidence in the program owing to renewed conflict but also flaws in its design and implementation. The program covered five provinces of eastern Congo and more than $200 million was spent, mainly on building or repairing more than 100 police stations and government buildings, reopening 1,400 kilometres of roads and training about 1,500 police and officials. STAREC's national coordinator, Alan Kashindi Asumani, told VOA the first phase of the program had limited results because it did not meet the population's real needs.
On s'est attaqué aux conséquences et non aux causes.
des conflits. Par exemple, au lieu de s'attaquer, par exemple...
Starek 1 addressed the consequences, but not the causes of conflict, he says. For example, instead of attacking poverty, which is one of the causes of conflict, it concentrated on repairing damage caused by warlords. A spokesman for civil society groups in North Kivu, Gento Maundu, agrees.
Le plus grand problème, c'est qu'on luttait contre. Le projet, c'était mettre fin, lutter contre la pauvreté.
The biggest problem with the first phase of Starek, he says, is that it didn't include a strategy for directly attacking poverty, which is the machine producing the armed groups, destabilizing eastern Congo. The new strategy for North Kivu and the other provinces is based on consultation with many people in the affected areas. One of the non-governmental organizations carrying out these consultations is International Alert. Maria Lange is International Alert's director in the DRC. She thinks Starek Phase 1 had several shortcomings.
I have come across projects where a prison was built that didn't have any bars, for example. You know, there were some examples of just really poor project execution. Some things were done well, but I think the lack of engagement by the Congolese government was definitely one of the main problems, as well as a lack of actually asking the communities what they need.
Starek has admitted that some of the police stations and offices that it built have been underutilized, as not enough police or officials were deployed to those places. The new strategy calls for ongoing democratic dialogue to ensure that projects meet people's needs and to make the government more accountable to its citizens. Changing the political culture may be harder to achieve than reducing poverty in some of Kivu's villages, but Lange believes those two aspects of the program have to go together.
There might be less interest by certain parts of government in the whole democratic dialogue aspects of that strategy, but I think that past experience, including Starek Phase 1, demonstrates that it's a very necessary component of development.
The stabilization strategy is just one of several blueprints aimed at achieving lasting peace in eastern Congo. There's also a program to demobilize Congolese armed groups, which the government has been urged to reactivate, and a peace and security agreement which the DRC signed with neighboring countries, including Rwanda and Uganda. International Alert is calling for the dialogue around Starek Phase 2 not to ignore those countries.
It should evidently include neighbouring countries as well that are also signatories to that, and I think we haven't seen very much progress on that front so far.
The DRC government, the United Nations and donors have been talking about the second phase of Starek for 3 years, and it sounds as if there is a lot more talking still to come. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Plotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, April 19th. It's football to the rescue as xenophobic attacks spread in South Africa, with at least 7 people killed in the past 2 weeks from attacks on mostly African immigrants in South Africa. The country's football authorities have turned to the beautiful game to help douse the fire. They say South Africa's national team will play 2 international friendly matches against neighboring countries in a bid to sensitize the public on the evils of xenophobia. We want to use the 2 high-profile international friendly matches as an instrument to unite this continent. What has been happening in the past few days have really left most people shocked and dismayed, says the chief executive officer of the South African Football Association, Dennis Mumble. Safa said the details of the 2 matches will be announced soon. Let's now head to Egypt. Death sentences handed down to 11 soccer fans were referred to the country's top religious authority, the Grand Mufti, for approval on Sunday. The 11 were sentenced to death in the retrial of over 70 defendants accused in a soccer riot in 2012 that left 74 dead. In Egypt, referral to the Grand Mufti is a necessary procedure before issuing a death sentence, according to the Egyptian law, though the religious opinion of the Mufti is not binding. The court has set May 30th for the date of the final verdict and placed a gag order on the case. Defendants hold the right to appeal against the verdict. 73 defendants were retried on charges of killing 74 Al Ahly fans after a match with Al Masry Football Club on February 1st. 2012. 9 police officers were tried in the case, but none of them was among the 11 who received the death sentence. In January 2013, a court sentenced 21 Al Masry fans to death while delaying the sentences on 52 others for legal reasons. Al Ahly fans welcomed the sentences, but were angered that none of the 9 police officers tried in the case was convicted. Turning to African club football, the first leg, second round matches are being played this weekend in the continent's 2 club football championships, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup. In the more prestigious Champions League, Almerek of Sudan, playing at home, beat Esperance of Tunisia 1-0, while Stade Malien of Mali and TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo played 2-2. The remaining 6 first leg matches are slated for today, Sunday. Second leg matches will be played between May 1st and 3rd, with the aggregate winners advancing to the lucrative group stage. Losers in the second round will enter into the CAF Confederation Cup playoff. The overall winner of the CAF Champions League gets $1.5 million, while the runner-up receives $1 million. And in the CAF Confederation Cup, Ghana Hearts of Oak scored perhaps one of the biggest victories this weekend. The Ghanaians traveled to Mali to beat home team Joliba 2-1 in the first leg of the second round. Gilbert Fiamenyu and Paul Akwa scored second-half goals for the Accra outfit before Isiaka Diarra reduced the tally from a penalty in Bamako. Hearts of Oak won the maiden edition of the Confederation Cup 11 years ago. Also, Club Africain of Tunisia finally got to play in this year's CAF Confederation Cup when it drew 1-1 against ASO Clef of Algeria. After drawing a bye in the preliminary round, the 1991 African champion got a first-round walkover when Nigeria's Dolphins arrived late in Tunis for the first leg. In other results, Warri Wolves of Nigeria beat visiting MK of the Democratic Republic of Congo 2-1. Young Africans of Tanzania and Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia played 1-1, while Royal Leopards of Swaziland defeated AS Vita Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo 1-0. The remaining three first-leg matches will be played today, Sunday. The winners of the Confederation Cup second round are drawn against the losers of the Champions League second round for the playoff stage of the competition that offers $660,000 first prize. Finally, Ethiopia's Portuguese coach Mariano Barreto will leave his post at the end of this month. That's 1 year before his two-year contract ends, according to the Ethiopian Football Federation. Barreto, a former Ghana coach and assistant manager of Russian side Dynamo Moscow, signed a two-year deal in 2014. But the 58-year-old coach failed to guide Ethiopia to this year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament. The team also reached the knockout round of qualifiers for last year's World Cup in Brazil, but lost over two legs to continental heavyweight Nigeria. Grouped alongside Algeria and Seychelles, Ethiopia kicks off its campaign for a place in the 2017 Nations Cup at home to Lesotho in June. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports, Nightline Africa Sports. Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Lelo makambo lobi makambo na lembie e lelo bitumba lobi kosona e na baye e na boyi kombe bisanzoto na matanga na lembie e Mario na lembie e Mario na baye e
oh Mario nasi na pekisa yo. Kulinga kapesi bazena mbongo Yo kandengi azaliko kabayo Na mitema ya basi pe na mibali Yo moto zena ba diplom mitano Mario Sala kameme foro luka mosala Mario Pona nino zako baby saka usambu sakombo nobo Mario Ah, nalembi
Ba protinga na pakolaka Zote koma sembe sembe Oko petenga na zoka Lobi na swa maladi ya kanser Lobi tango na kopola yo, kimi na ye Mario na ba ye Mario na lembi ye
Ba familia Mario bakani saka Mario ape saka nga mosoro Nzo kanga moto na lati saka E na li saka e na lali saka e Mario na lembi ye Nanda konanga Mario Bonanini nyongo ya polingo e
Kupetenga na suwa E paizua ya lokuta E paizua ya biloko e
Bakuta kinga na yango
Ikambo moke mosala kobo ma
Biloko ya ndako e
Na somba Na lebie e Mario na baye yo Kene Mario
Mario, okutinga na biloko mombali mosusu asomba. Oyoko ilingi ya kofanga te Mario. Oyoko ilingi te olia na mesa.
kaka soki zoe kangyo na poitrine oniaga ko beta ngai nako boma biloko mario sina selisa yo mingi diploma simanga mona selisa ki yo mario bongo le ngaku mwa sima be mario di kambote ah mokili ezaka kapoye
mobale akutinga na bomengo asengi ya komandenga na ndimi mobale akutinga na bangenge asengi ya dirigenga na ndimi na bandiko bima na ye babandiko mpenga ye monsieur mario abimbi moto akanisi biloko na ngai ya ye mario nabaye yo kende mario nalembi yo
mario asongi epai ya baboti akuti mbeto na ye ya bomwana ekomi ntango akolala mbeto mokuse makolo milai mario mario nalembi somba mbeto na baye mario nalembi
koyoka motema pasi te ndakonga moko nakutaka bilamba nasombela yo natikeli yo souvenir ya bolingo ezali na lavage nakotindela yo na bato mario nalembi yo kende na yo na baye yo
mario à l'eau pour la fusée, Mario. Mario, mon salako bête d'un gars de banadi coco. Banango ya yo. Olingo beba mama mo bokoli.
Epaizua ya biloko akutakinga na yango ikambo moke mosala koboma biloko ya ndako era soma na baye yo mario nalembi yo bima bima na baye yo
mario nalembo ngwali kelemba mitutuku misato na sombi mercedes 190 na ibisi mario mokomosi tobima tokende kosa promenade tokomi na nzela mario abi na ngai yo zonga kotenga nazali nakumba voiture mpo bamonaka ngangu nasombeli yo yango na ibisi mario te ngambina na poso nakumba mpo eloko nasombi sika bato nyonso bamona mpe ngangu nasombi toweli volonga na mario mario akiteli nga voiture na nzete
nzoto ezali nano ya meme olingi obebisanga elongi pasi nyonso ozwaka mosala kobebisa bango bilongi kemba na nga na estope nalembi yo mario papa na baye yo kende na yo nalembi yo
sur ma dame à la pommade. Oh! A tes amouines et à montagne. Alina Koba la basse à âge naïete. Alina Obeba maman Mobokoli. Mario. Mario, valise zana ete. Soki mama moboko ya bengani ye. Akanga kobe bilomo na liputa ye. Babro sata, masini ya mandepo. Kisanola, kut. Thank you.
benga na nimi na bandiko bimana ye na bandiko benga ye monsieur mo pale avimbi moto akanisi biloko na ngai ya ye mo vale akutinga na ngenge asengi akomandenga na nimi na bandiko bimana ye na bandiko benga ye monsieur mario avimbi moto akanisi biloko na ngai ya ye Mario na ba ye yo
ya yo
bima na yo na le mi yo me ma bila mana ba ye yo
Mario a travers yo na pesa baliki mususu toli boku mi ko linga tasi ya bato pona ba mbongo na bango mobali ya sali mbongo a pesi mwasi yo kei oke ko vande la ye po si sa yango Yo Mario, okutinda ku apartement kitoko. Biloko imuta sombite, yo lali ovandi telephone television. Oh Mario, kanisa ke mobali wa somba ki onta mona ki pasi. Likambo nini Mario? Ah. Likambo nalo bangu de zaite. Ezaite, ezaite, ezaite Mario.
Koyo kamote ma pasi tena ko ngamoto na futaka. Il a mana sombela yo, na tikeli yo souvenir ya bolingo. Oye zalina lavage, na kotinde la yo na pato mwika. Mario, na lembi yo, kende mapa na lembi yo. Bima bima na paye yo.
Mario, ba sapato ya Weston, na ba sapato ya Provo, o lataka. Kaka mwasi muta sombela kayo. Bilamba ya Valentino, complet ya cuir, na ba chemise ya soie, ba ceinture ya lézard. Kaka mwasi muta sombela kayo Mario. Ba suki ekome kolala milelu milelu singa singa na moto. Kaka mwasi muta futaka coiffeuse wana. Ah,
ba prodinga na pakolaka, zoto ekoma sembe sembe. Okopete nga na soka, lobi na so maladi ya cancer. Lobi tango na kopola yo boinga ye. Mario
Matela na ye ya bomwana e komi tango akola la matela e tomoka e bimisa pasi polo mwe na baye e Mario matela mokosa na lembie somba matela na baye
lelo kosona lo bibitumba na baye lelo makambo lo bimakambo na lembie na boyi komebi sanzoto na manzaka na baye yo Mario, na lembio, mema bilamba na lembio, koti ke loko tena baye yo.
Mario na utizando, na kuti na ndako Mario asiliki, na kanisi bana mosala balambi de biyoko malamute, ngamoko na koti na cuisine, na lambeli Mario, na tina mesa Mario aboyi bolia, asiliki. A bengi nga pembe na bi sheri, oni kina na siri nga bite na yebite, a bi ba komple wo ya len bibi sikoyo, suko sombiri nga te li bale kukufo ya mbalo yo. Ah!
Mario akuti nga na ngenge, asengi ya dirije nga na nimi, na bandiko bimana ye, babandiko benga ye monsieur. Mario avimbi moto, akanisi biloko na nga ya ye. Mario na ba ye yo. Mobali mapena lembio Kopeta kangana lembio papa
Ah Mario vraiment kende no kaka Na ba grand frère la quartier Okoma ko sela bango zuwa Bato wa mouni sikanga na koli Mario Ah Mario akomona tanga bako sala versement Yambongo ba yiko tiki langai Mario alongoli sengle Alingi sikwa sala konti yambongo Zue tondi mbanga na mitoki Mario, membo mongo zo konte a yo
Akomete nga na zua Epa izua ya lokuta Epa izua ya biloko Akuta kinga na yango Ikambo moke mosala Kobo mabiloko ya dako E na somba Na lembi yo oh. Mario papa na baye yo oh. Kende na
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Roman's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. United States President John F. Kennedy once famously remarked that victory had many fathers, but defeat was an orphan. This observation may help us to understand the xenophobic attack that is now occurring in many parts of South Africa, particularly Durban and Johannesburg. The new phase of attack was supposed to have been triggered by a statement by the Zulu King, who asked for all foreigners to leave South Africa. The violence of this attack caused the authorities to put into secure custody many of the emigrants, but their shops were destroyed and many of them were abused. The question that is being asked is why now? President Zuma condemned all these attacks, saying there was no justification for the attacks. And there have been also demonstrations by a large number of South Africans who came as far as Johannesburg to Durban to demonstrate against these xenophobic attackers. Many Africans are scratching their heads to find out why so many South Africans are ungrateful, not recognizing the enormous assistance rendered by Africa for the liberation of South Africa. There has been also efforts by some governments, like Malawi, to evacuate their nationals. But I think the fault might be well with the authorities in not properly educating South Africans as to what happened during the struggle in South Africa. This new generation of South Africans, particularly the youth, are fully convinced that the victory against apartheid was due solely by their efforts. They have no knowledge of the support of the frontline states like Mozambique, like Zambia, and Zimbabwe. So when they see these Africans in their midst, they think that they are there just to take their jobs from them. I can recall that when the Museum Against Apartheid was first built and opened, I visited that museum. It's a marvelous museum, well depicted, but having spent so much time in that museum, I was surprised that there was very little recognition of what was done in the United Nations by the Africans and the Organization of African Unity, what was done by Africans in other parts of Africa, and also, in fact, about the global community. I did mention this to some colleagues at time in South Africa. I went there 2 years ago, and there still was no recognition of this. And this museum is visited regularly by many school children of South Africa, and their image of the struggle is shaped by what they see. So I think the authorities themselves have to begin some kind of education of the South Africans as to the contribution of other Africans to the victory in against apartheid. It was not only their own efforts. Yes, they made tremendous efforts, the ANC, the PAC, but Africa as a whole also made tremendous efforts. And all I can say is this, that based on my close observation and involvement with South Africa at the United Nations, that the victory against apartheid belonged not only to South Africans, but to many others, including the global community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Jackson Vonganyi, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, he who has not reached his destination never gets tired. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For many years now, the United States has been an unequivocal advocate for a free and open internet, a decentralized, inclusive platform that belongs to everyone, one that is free from arbitrary intergovernmental control. We do this because the present multi-stakeholder model of internet governance helps to protect fundamental freedoms online and promote continuous innovation, allowing all stakeholders to have a voice and to express themselves, and also because the internet has an unprecedented potential to facilitate economic growth and create opportunities for developed, emerging, and developing economies alike. Today, more than half of the world's population has no access to the Internet. At the same time, over the next decade, globally, some 1.8 billion new consumers will enter the marketplace. As Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs Charles Rifkin recently said, almost all of them will be from emerging markets. This will create increased demand and global production, which means economic opportunities, as well as improved goods and services for emerging and developing country consumers. That's because the Internet enables even the smallest companies and entrepreneurs to sell their products, services, and ideas internationally. In emerging and developing nations, whose small businesses are so often the backbone of their economies, this access to global markets would have dramatic results, said Assistant Secretary Rifkin. The Internet will link entrepreneurs and small manufacturers to global supply chains. By connecting more people to each other and the information and services available, we could help ensure that all populations have access to technology. We can also ensure that no singular group is excluded due to barriers such as prohibitively high costs, lack of network connectivity, or social or cultural hurdles. The global digital economy is rapidly transforming the emerging markets that are the key to future growth and globally shared prosperity, said Assistant Secretary Rifkin. With something so essential, beneficial, and central to modern life, it's imperative that we do everything in our power to preserve this precious asset. We must do so thoughtfully and with our eyes firmly focused on the futures of our children.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.